It's my pleasure to call upon Rabbi Steinberg. We'll be discussing the implications of this information that we have in terms of disclosure. And following this session, then we'll have a question and answer period.
So before this comes up, I think that's the right moment to join all those who thank Rabbi Kelman, Davidson Kelman, Dr. Friedman, really for an excellent Gashmi and Ruchni conference that we experienced, and that is just the opening for the next one, which will be the 10th one, and that is really a challenge for you to make it something unique, outstanding. If you'll invite me, I don't know. Okay, so talking about disclosure of information, actually, there are two components to it. There is the disclosure of information to the patient, and there is disclosure of information of the patient to others. These are two separate entities, have separate ethical, halachic significance, and certainly different approaches. So we'll start with the disclosure of information to the patient, and we'll deal a little bit with the ethical aspects of it, and then some of the halachic rules. So as you all know, secular ethics has been very monotonous in the way that there are four principles, assuming that if you know the four principles, you throw it on every case, every dilemma, and you'll get your solution, which obviously doesn't work in the real world. It's good for philosophers, for teaching, but not really for the real world. But here is, if you take the three of the four which are relevant to this issue, how would you deal with the question, what, how much to disclose to the patient? So if autonomy is the leading principle, then you are obligated always to disclose everything to every patient, because every patient has his autonomy to know anything about himself. A, because prima facie that is ethically required, and the consequent of it is that he should make decisions. And if he doesn't know the facts, he doesn't know the issues that relate to him, how can he make an informed consent? So from an autonomous point of view, no matter what will happen, whatever you as a physician know about the patient, you have to disclose it to the patient. If we go by the principle of beneficence, then sometimes it is very important for the benefit of the patient to tell him the complete information, but sometimes it's preferable to hide some of the information for his benefit, judged by the physician. It's a subjective judgment, but it is a real judgment. Sometimes knowing too much may cause more harm than benefit. So you should not disclose everything oftentimes. And if you go by the principle of non-maleficence, then sometimes you shouldn't disclose anything, because sometimes a patient can take the information, especially if it's bad information, to a degree that it will really harm him. And if do no harm is the principle, then sometimes you shouldn't say anything. Perhaps even lie to him in order for him not to be harmed. So we have principles, but depending which of the principles overrides the others, will determine how much and what type of information you're obligated to give to your patient. By the way, although from an ethical point of view there are four principles, in fact, most ethicists and many legislations are based only on one principle, just on autonomy. Autonomy has become the overriding principle, and hence, if you have an information about a patient, and from an autonomous point of view, you should disclose it to him, but you make beneficence or non-maleficence calculations, you may even be sued because you didn't tell him everything, and he could make his informed consent the right way. But from an ethical point of view, taking all those into account doesn't make sense that always autonomy should prevail. Now, from this aspect, why is it right from an ethical point of view to disclose information to the patient? Because, as we said, telling the truth is a prima facie obligation, the right of autonomy, as we discussed, the right of free choice, and there are many surveys showing that indeed patients want to know everything about themselves and they handle it quite well. These are studies that were done primarily in the United States, and I maintain that they are very cultural dependent, and what is right for the United States is not necessarily right for maybe Canada, or maybe not, but certainly not right for Greece, or for Israel, or for India, because the culture is there different, and there's a famous story about a hematologist who trained in the United States, and she was told that whenever you have an information autonomy, you have to tell the patient. She comes back home to Greece, and the first child that she diagnoses as having acute leukemia, she gets the parents and says, you know, your child has leukemia, he's going to die, he needs such and such treatment, the treatment will be very difficult, and so far. And the next day, she gets a letter that she's fired. Because in Greece, you don't talk that way. You don't say it to the parents in such a way. So the culture may be different, and what is right in one place not necessarily is right in the other place, and therefore the surveys have to be taken with a grain of salt. Now, there are also practical considerations why it is right to tell patients what they have, even if the information is bad. And here you have a list of many, many considerations which I think all are right in general, and indeed they make sense, especially in our age, where if you don't tell a patient, he opens the internet and with a little information that he has, he gets to the fuller information, but sometimes the wrong way, because what he finds out, he or she finds out in the internet is not what you as a physician can tell them in the right way. So there's a whole list why it is good, practically speaking, to inform the patient. On the other hand, there are both ethical and practical considerations not to tell every patient everything, whether not to tell at all, or to tell partial information, or even to lie to the patient whenever it is important. So from a ethical point of view, as we said, primum non nocere, first of all, don't cause harm. Sometimes bad news really cause harm, and there are patients who can't handle it. It is apparently not as frequent as the surroundings of patients think, and usually we get family members who come to us and say, please don't tell the patient anything, we know him, he will commit suicide, he can't handle it, you tell us and we will find the way how to treat. But it is not necessarily true, and sometimes the patient can handle it much better than the family expects it to handle it, and in fact, many times the patient already knows more than the family thinks he knows, and he just plays the role of being someone who doesn't know to protect his family. So it goes in a circle. But there are patients who can't handle bad news. And hence, the value of life, if it can endanger the life of the patient by informing him, is overriding autonomy, at least from a religious point of view, not only Jewish, also other religions feel the same way. Now, to tell the truth is a right thing to do, but truth is not an absolute value except for the Kantian philosophy. In the Kantian philosophy, truth is an absolute value. You can never say something which is not true, because that is immoral to deviate from truth. But in real life, no one of us is saying always, all the time, only the truth. It doesn't exist. The Gemara says that there was one town that was called the Kshita. Kshita in Aramaic is truth. And this town, their behavior was that they say only truth. And once a person came and became a citizen in this city, but he wasn't trained the way the city behaved. And there was a first death because when he came. So they found out that he lied. So they obviously expelled him from the city. So there was one city that the Gemara says that they kept truth, meaning that the Gemara realized that the whole world, other than Kshita, don't say always the truth. And we'll see in a minute that truth, even from a Jewish, Hashkafic, and Halachic point of view, is not always mandatory. And we are allowed sometimes to deviate from the truth for higher values. But in Kantian philosophy, that is an absolute dictum. By the way, there is a story, I don't know if the story is true, but as you know, Kant, Immanuel Kant, was born in Königsberg, lived in Königsberg, and died in Königsberg. He never left the city, he never married, he was a single fellow who philosophized. So to philosophize, you can say there are absolute terms. So the story is that truth, according to him, is an absolute value, but also saving life is an absolute value. So now the story is that someone is pursuing, running after another one and wants to kill him. The one that is pursued runs to the house of Kant, knocks at the door. Kant opens the door. He runs in and he hides under the bed of Kant. 5 minutes later, the pursuer comes, knocks at the door, and says, "Mr. Kant, is so-and-so in your house?" What will Mr. Kant say? If he keeps truth, he must say, yes, he is here. But that will cause the person to die, because the pursuer will kill him. If he wants to save the life as the higher value, he has to lie. He has to say he is not here. So how does he get out of it? In other words, absolute values are good for lectures. In real life, they never go in parallel lines. They always cross each other. So you have to prioritize the values. And therefore, none of the values are absolute values. And in fact, if you look in the Sefer, in the Yud Gimel Ikarim that the Rambam said, an Ikar in the Rambam is an absolute value. That's the translation of an Ikar. So there are 13 Ikarim. None of them has to do with human relationship. Neither truth, no life, no war, nothing is an absolute value. The absolute values are only spiritual ones. To believe in God, God is one. To believe in the Torah, to believe in Trias Amesim. None of the Yud Gimel Ikarim have to do with human relations, because none of human relations can be an Ikar, can be an absolute value. So if we don't take it as an absolute value, then sometimes we're allowed to deviate from the truth. So these are some of the issues. Now, what is the truth in medicine? Do we really know? We as physicians sometimes think that we know exactly what the prognosis is and what the diagnosis is. We have no doubts, and this is the truth, and we are contemplating whether to tell it. But how often do we have mistakes in prognostication, in diagnosis, in treatment? So even if we would like to go according to the truth, not always do we know what the truth is. So therefore, that is really more on a philosophic level than on a practical level. So now let's look a little bit on the halachic aspect. So there are two contradictory stories in Tanakh from which you may derive whether to tell a patient the whole truth, even if it's a bad news, or not. The first one is the story of the king of Aram, of Ben-Hadad, that was a messenger was sent to Elisha, to the prophet, to ask whether he will recover from a certain disease. And Elisha said something which in Tanakh there is a kri and ktiv. The kri is that he told him, tell him, lo with a vav, lamed vav, tell him, chayo yichye, he will live. But he knew, Elisha, by prophecy, that he will not live. So he lied to him. He told the messenger to tell Ben Hadad that he will live. The ktiv is lamed aleph, a more law. You should say, no, chayo yichye, he will not live. So in other words, the truth was that he will not live, and Elisha knew it, but what he related to him was that he will live. So we see from here that sometimes you lie to the patient for whatever reason. So as we said, according to the written text, it should be disclosed, and according to the Masoretic reading, it should not be disclosed. The other story is the story of Yeshayahu and Chizkiyahu. Kadosh Baruch Hu sent Yeshayahu to Chizkiyahu when he was sick and dying, and Yeshayahu came to him and told him directly, Tzav leveitcha ki metata, write your will because you are going to die. And the Midrash says that Chizkiyahu told Yeshayahu, how do you talk to me? Is this how you talk to a patient? You come straightforward and you say, you are going to die, write your will. That is how you talk to a patient? You tell him, drink this, don't drink that, give him all kinds of counseling in order for him to feel a little better, but not to tell him directly you are going to die. That is not the way to talk. So here we see that Yeshayahu thought that you have to tell the truth, the patient, even if it is the worst truth, the truth of dying. And Chizkiyahu thought that that's not the right way to do. So what is right with all these stories, how to behave? There is another halachic dictum, which is called vidui, which a patient who is dying, we are coming to his room and we tell him, say vidui. Repent on your lifetime bad deeds that you did, which implies very clearly that you are going to die. So we are going to tell someone who is going to die, say vidui, which everyone understands that if I am required to say vidui, means you told me I'm going to die. There's a famous story about Rabbi Levine, who used to go to visit the sick and the prisoners. He was a big Baal Chesed. He used to come every day to Bikur Cholim Hospital and go into the internal ward and tell everyone to say together vidui. Because he said, even someone who is going to live can say vidui. There's nothing wrong to say the vidui now, even I'm going to live. Some of those people are really going to die, and their vidui is important to be said now. But to tell just them to say vidui would mean that I told them that they are going to die. In that way, they said vidui, but I didn't tell them that they are going to die because everyone is saying vidui. So that is a way out of that. So if we are to sum up the examples in Tanakh and the halacha of vidui and the pros and cons, when and what to say to the patient, we come up with the following. Autonomy, halachically, is a very limited value. I cannot say autonomously, I want to write a letter or an email to my friend on Shabbat. I have my autonomy, I can do it. I can't do it. My autonomy is limited. My autonomy is only up to where halacha comes. So for instance, if I was invited to this conference, I was autonomous to decide whether to come or not to come, or maybe not. But but that was an indifferent decision, that there's no halacha to say that I have to come, and there's no halacha to say that I don't have to come, so I have my autonomy to decide. But if my decision impinges on halachic dictum, I am limited with my autonomy. So autonomy, by definition, is quite limited. On the other hand, the value of life is certainly a supreme important value, much more than the secular world accepts. And as I said yesterday, that is also the belief of other religions, including Christianity, and therefore we have a common ground against the secular world that doesn't relate to the value of life per se. Today, the value of life is almost irrelevant from a secular point of view. It's only the quality of life that counts, but not the value per se. And from a halachic point of view, the value of life is of supreme importance. The truth is also a relative value and not an absolute value, as we will see in a minute. On the other hand, there is an obligation upon a physician to treat, which again is unique to halacha, that is not common to the secular world. According to the secular world, a physician has an option to treat, but he is not obligated to treat. If he decides he wants to take a vacation and he doesn't care what will happen to his patients, you can't do anything to him. And what is even more unique to Jewish law is that the patients have an obligation to seek medical help. It is not optional on a patient to go for treatment. A patient must seek help because v'nishmartem me'od nafshotechem, it is a chiyuv, a biblical chiyuv. So if we look a minute on the value of truth. So on the one hand, truth portrays one of the characteristics of God, Hashem Elokim Emet, that is one of the characters, if we can say so, of God. Truth portrays the Torah, Torat Hashem Emet. That is, again, a true thing. Truth is one of the three basic principles upon which the world is preserved. Olam Omed, Ala Emet, Ala Shalom, Ala Ava. And obviously, one should strive to say the truth and not to be double-faced, not to think one thing and say something different. Falsehood is wrong, and midvar sheker tirchak is something that we all know. By the way, it's an interesting statement of the Torah. It doesn't say lo teshaker, like a regular love. Why does it say midvar sheker tirchak? So on the one hand, it is not a love. Midvar sheker tirchak doesn't make it a love by halachic criteria. On the other hand, it is even stronger than a regular love because it's not only don't lie, but distance yourself from lying, even stay away even further from lying. There's a famous story of Rabbi Akiva Eiger that he used to write tshuvas to people, and people that he didn't know, he addressed them with all kinds of titles like it was customary, Rav HaGaon, Rash Kabag, and so and so. And then he wrote the answer a little bit further away from the list of titles. Because he said, Midvar Sheker Tirchak. I don't know if he really deserves all these praises. Now, on the other hand, we see stories in the Tanakh whereby the truth wasn't kept, not only by human beings, but even by God himself. The story of Abraham and Sarah. It says that Sarah laughed when HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when the Malachim said that she will have a child. And he said, and she said, why couldn't I have a child? V'adoni zaken, because my husband is old. How can I have a child when my husband is 100 years old? When HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Lama ze tzachaka Sarah to Abraham, leimor v'ani zakanti. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avraham Avinu that Sarah said that she can't have a child because she is old. Why? HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want to insult Avraham Avinu and say that Sarah blamed him for not having the child because he is old. That wasn't the truth. The truth was that she said that my husband is old. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu repeated her saying in a false way in order to keep peace between Avraham and Sarah. The Gemara brings it. It's not my idea. The same is the story with the brothers of Yosef. When Yaakov Avinu died, and they were afraid that Yosef will now take revenge on the brothers who sold him to Egypt, so they came to Yosef and said, Avinu tziva lifne moto le'mor, ana sana pesha achecha v'chatatam. Our father commanded us that you should forgive us. Says the Gemara, we don't find a hint that Yaakov Avinu said it. Yaakov Avinu never said that Yosef should forgive the brothers. So they lied in order to save their lives, and they said, our father said, because if they will come and say, just forgive us, they were afraid this won't make enough of an impact on Yosef. Now the famous Keitzot Meragdin Lifnei Akala, you know the Gemara in Exubes, Keitzot Meragdin Lifnei Akala literally means how do you dance before the Kala, but Chazal didn't teach steps of dancing. That wasn't the idea of the question Keitzot Meragdin. Keitzot Meragdin, what do you say to the bride to make her happy? So Beit Shammai said, Kala kemot shehi, you tell the truth, the absolute truth. So if she's ugly, you say, you're an ugly bride. What can we do? That's how you are. And Beit Hillel say, you always say Kala na'a v'chasuda. So Beit Shammai said, how can you always say Kala na'a v'chasuda? Here is a Kala that doesn't have an eye, doesn't have a leg. She looks very ugly, and you say Kala na'a v'chasuda? Say Beit Hillel, yes, we say a little bit of a lie in order to make the couple happy. Some say that it's not even a lie because they say to the bridegroom that for him she is really pretty, pretty enough that he married her. So that is a different looking on what is pretty or not. But the pshat is that you lie. You lie in order to keep them happy. Whenever there is danger to life, obviously life takes precedence over telling the truth, and you're allowed to lie in order to get it through. There are other examples in Shas where you can deviate from the truth for various reasons. So the principle is don't come out from here saying that halachically you can lie and from now on you are lying every minute. That obviously is not the intention. It is just to say that it is a relative value. It is an important value, but it is relative, and you have to weigh it against other principles and sometimes override this value. So truth is an exceptionally valuable principle, but not an absolute principle, so that preservation of life or peace takes precedence over truth. So that is as far as telling the truth to the patient. So what is the rule behind all this? So I think that instead of asking the question, should we tell the patient everything? Should we tell him parts of the information? Should we tell him nothing about it? Should we lie to him? That is not the real question. I think the real question today is that at the end of the day, the patient should know what he has, because it's impossible nowadays to conceal it or to lie. People are intelligent enough that you can't lie to them. I remember ages ago when I was a medical student still in Hadassah, there is still the institution for cancer, which is called Machon Sharet. That's the name of the cancer institution. And if a patient was diagnosed, let's say, with lung cancer, and he needed radiation or chemotherapy, and he was sent to Machon Sharet. So we used to tell the patient, you have a pneumonia, and we are sending you to Machon Sharet to take an X-ray. He got an X-ray, which was a treatment of radiotherapy, but it is because you have a pneumonia. We were afraid to tell him that he has cancer. Today, it won't work. Everyone knows that you go to Machon Sharet because you have cancer. No, you don't go to Machon Sharet to get an X-ray for pneumonia. That just doesn't work anymore. And especially with the internet and with friends and so on. So therefore, at the end of the day, the diagnosis, whatever is important, has to be relayed. I think the important question is how to do it. Not whether or not to do it, but how to do it. And that is what we should teach young physicians, the art of disclosing information, and not the philosophical question whether or not to disclose. And the best way to do it is let the patient lead you on how much information he wants at the moment. He may want now only a certain part, maybe tomorrow he'll have a few questions and he wants a little more. Let the patient lead you. So you start with a general thing which you think is important for the patient to know. You do it in a nice way, and I'm sure everyone of the physicians here and everywhere know that even years later, patients remember the nuances, how you worded the words that you didn't even intend to say it one way or the other, but for him it was very important and he remembers it. And sometimes even your facial expression when you told him makes a difference on how you tell it to him. The environment where you tell him. You don't tell him in the corridor, by the way, your biopsy came back and it looks very bad, I'll talk to you later. That you never do, right? That's not a way to do it. You are going to tell him the truth, but that is not the right way to do. So there are a lot of examples on how to relay the information rather than discuss whether or not to tell the information. So I think at the end of the day, the patient will know what they have, they need to know it, they need to be educated so that they can make decisions. It is also good for the confidence and for their peace of mind that they know, but more important is how to do it. Now, what about disclosing the information to someone else, which is called today medical confidentiality? So you won't find in Shulchan Aruch, in Rambam, Hilchot medical confidentiality. There's no such paragraph. Because from a halachic point of view, there is no difference between talebearing and gossip of medical staff and just neighborhood staff. If someone tells a story about a friend, that is a gossip which is forbidden the same way as telling information on a patient to someone else. There's nothing unique about disclosing information. So medical ethics, secular medical ethics, made it a whole field by itself, medical confidentiality, but really it is a subtext in the general prohibition on Loshon Hara and Rechilus. They related from Benjamin Franklin that three may keep a secret if two of them are dead. If three know, to keep a secret probably won't work unless two of them die, and then you can keep this secret. So it is almost impossible. Again, you can preach as much as you want that medical confidentiality is important, and you should preach, and you should understand that it is important, but the reality is that people talk, and that is something that has to be taken into account. And again, I remember as a medical student, in my days, a medical student didn't have a car to go to the university. Today, a high school child has a car to go to school, so we went by bus. And when I was sitting as a medical student in the bus, together with residents who went to the hospital, you could hear in the bus all the stories of Yankel and Beryl and so on, what happened to him yesterday and what today. They talk between them, and it's in the bus, and everyone hears. And in a small city, everyone knows who they refer to. So that is certainly something that shouldn't be done. So halachically, everyone knows, and I won't go over all the Hilchos Rechilus and Loshon Hara, but you know that this is a biblical prohibition. According to the Chofetz Chaim, which, by the way, the important work that everyone agrees of him was the Mishnah Brura, yet he is called the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim is his book on Issur Rechilus and Loshon Hara. And he is named after this work rather than after the work of Mishneh Berurah. You don't call him the Mishneh Berurah, you call him the Chofetz Chaim. And that shows how much importance he himself had to telling Rechilus and Loshon Hara. And he calculated that sometimes if a person tale bears, he can violate 17 negative biblical precepts, 14 positive preference, and incur 3 curses. So imagine you say one story that is an issur rechilus, and you may transgress that many lavim, esin, and arurim. That is really mind-boggling. There's almost no parallel to it in other issurim. So obviously, everyone knows that a physician who possesses information about a patient, whether provided by the patient or by others, is prohibited by laws against talebearing and evil gossip from disclosing that information. But there are exceptions to the rule. And here, there's a difference between secular ethics and legislations and halacha. According to halacha, if a third innocent party might be injured by not telling the secret of the person, you are allowed, and some say even obligated, to tell it to whoever is involved in it. Whereas from a medical point, from an ethical point of view, and from a legislative point of view, at least in Israel, it has to be stipulated in the law when you're allowed to breach confidentiality. Otherwise, you're not allowed to do it, even if someone will be harmed. There is a situation in Israel where infectious, contagious diseases are allowed to breach the confidentiality of the patient and tell the Ministry of Health or tell the neighborhood that this person has a contagious disease, and in order to not spread the disease. But the law enumerates the diseases which are allowed to be transmit, the information of it is allowed to be transmitted. What happened was that this law was written prior to the AIDS epidemic, and AIDS was not listed in this list. So there was a case of a husband who had AIDS, and the physician said, you know, we must tell your wife, because if you'll have relations with her, she will be infected and she may die. It's not a simple situation. So he said, you're not allowed to tell my wife, and it's not stipulated in the law, therefore legally you're not allowed to do it. And they went to court, and the court approved the position of the patient. So if it is measles or mumps, it's listed, so this you're allowed to tell. But HIV you're not allowed to tell. So the Knesset had to enact an amendment to the law to add AIDS into the list. So I told the committee, why don't you change the whole policy? Why don't you say every infectious disease that may cause harm to a third innocent party, you can disclose, because today you added AIDS, tomorrow there'll be another disease, Ebola or something else that you didn't think about, and you'll have again to convene the Knesset and to add this. It doesn't make any sense. So from a halachic point of view, it's really senseless. Anything that can cause harm to someone else, you're allowed to breach the confidentiality. So for instance, that is accepted by the law as well. I am a pediatric neurologist. I have a patient with epilepsy. The patient comes at age to get a driver license. I'm obligated to report to the authority that he has epilepsy and he can't be a driver, because by him being a driver, he may have an attack, he will kill himself, that is not my immediate concern, but he will kill someone else because of the accident that he will cause, and in order to protect someone else, I'm allowed to breach confidentiality. So these are examples where one is allowed to say it, and some say even that you are obligated to say it. And that comes from the biblical prohibition. It says, "Lo telech rachil ba'amecha, ve'lo ta'amod al dam re'echa." That's the pasuk. It comes together. "Lo telech rachil ba'amecha." You shouldn't talebear about your friend, and "Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa." You shouldn't stand idle by the blood of your friend. So it goes in both directions. Sometimes telling the secret of the patient may cause him to die, because of shame, because of anger, because of whatever you caused him harm. And sometimes not telling his secret may cause the life of someone else because he didn't know the fact. So, lo telech achil ba'amecha is forbidden because lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, but sometimes it's obligated because you want to save someone else. So it goes in both directions. So there are, as we said, exceptions, but even those exceptions, the Chofetz Chaim, in his book, writes a whole host of stipulations, of qualifications, when and how are you allowed to disclose the information when this information may harm someone else. So in principle, you are allowed to do it, but who and how is qualified. For instance, it should be clear that withholding the information might lead to serious harm. It is not that if I don't tell someone, so the other one will be a little bit offended and he can go over it. That is not enough of a reason to tell the secret. But if someone may be harmed, and not necessarily life harm, the example that the Chofetz Chaim himself gives, he doesn't talk about medical examples, but the example is that a woman was working at a house of a certain family, and she was caught stealing. So she was fired. The next day, this woman that had her yesterday hears that her neighbor hires her. Says the Chofetz Chaim, she should go to the neighbor and say, she stole from my house. You do whatever you want. You want to take a fine, but you should know that she stole. So that is something to prevent damage, not necessarily life-threatening situations, but even such kind of a damage. It obviously has to be factual, accurate, and not exaggerated. And the sole intent of disclosure should be to prevent harm to other person, not because of hatred of the person. I hate this guy, so I want to tell about him as many bad things as I can. And some of them are really allowed to be told because they may cause harm. But my intent is not to prevent the harm. My intent is to punish him because I hate him. That is forbidden. The teller must ascertain prior to disclosure that the information will be used beneficially. If, for instance, I know for sure that no matter what I'll tell the other party, he will continue the way he is doing it without the knowledge, so why tell it? If I know that this couple is going to be married no matter what, and I know something that is inappropriate in one of the sides, telling the other side is irrelevant because they already decided no matter what, they'll get married, so then there's no point of telling it. One of the important qualifications are that I know firsthand the information. So sometimes we as physicians are in a more delicate position than others. For instance, I have a neighbor, and I heard that this neighbor has cancer. I don't know it firsthand, I heard. And now he's going to marry someone, and he doesn't want to tell that he is sick. I'm not allowed to tell the other one that I know that he has cancer because I don't know it firsthand. But if I'm his physician, and I hear that he is going to marry a woman and he doesn't want to disclose to her, I have an obligation to tell her because she will be harmed with such. She may want to anyway, that's fine, but she may be harmed in this situation. We encounter it, at least I encounter it many times, treating children that grow up, and now they are in shiduchim, and the other side calls me up and says, what does this fellow has? Do I have to tell him or not? So legally, I'm not allowed to do it, because by law, I have to keep the confidentiality of my patient, even if it will cause harm to the other side. Halachically, I'm obligated to tell what I know, and I know it firsthand. So the way that I handle it is, I tell the one that asks, he should get permission from the parents of the side that he is interested to know what he has, and then one of two things will happen. If they give permission, then I can tell, even legally. If they don't give permission, they must understand that there is a problem without me telling them, and if they are smart, they'll stay away from it, right? Because why don't they want me to tell? So that is the way that we are dealing with it, but we are halachically obligated to prevent the harm to someone else. So who is obligated to disclose? Certainly the person himself. And first thing that we as physicians, if we know that someone has an illness or a condition that can harm someone else, we should persuade the person himself to tell it. If it's shiduchim, we have to persuade the boy or the girl herself, himself, or their parents to tell the other side. It's always healthier to enter a shiduch when things are known rather than conceal now and later find out. Halachically, it may be kiddushei ta'ut, and then there's all kinds of problems, and socially, psychologically, there will be a lot of trouble, so better to tell. So we should persuade the person himself to tell it. If he doesn't want to do it, whoever knows firsthand, let's say it's a disease and I'm the physician, then I am obligated to do this process. So these are some of the examples that we are allowed to breach confidentiality in order to avoid harm from someone else. And again, the principle is there. The question is how to do it. And as I said, the best way to do it is to persuade a person himself to be honest and disclose for his own benefit, because the consequences of not doing it are many times worse than doing it. In Shiduchim, there is this rule that Rav Eliashiv and Shlomo Zalman Neuerbach and others say, let's say one of the boy or the girl have epilepsy. If they'll put a sign on their forehead, I have epilepsy because I'm disclosing what I have, no one will even start a shidduch process with such a person. On the other hand, if they'll go along without telling, and it will become already almost knowing, and now they will tell, there might be a big crisis. So the advice is to start without telling. If there is a feeling that it's becoming warmer, then it's the time to tell, and then if it breaks, it's not so heartbreaking at this stage. Whereas if you keep on not telling and it becomes more involved, then it will be much worse when you tell it. But you have to tell it, either yourself or anyone who knows about it, because this may cause harm to a third party. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Steinberg. Once again, I'd like to thank the speakers. However, if there's some interest, we'll take some questions now for a few moments. I'll open the floor. To those that are leaving, Tzeischem l'shalom, have a safe trip. There is a box lunch outside. Obviously, take one each, right? Last year, for some reason, that didn't work out quite well. Have a wonderful trip home, and we hope to see you again next year, wherever that may be. Questions to the floor. Dr. Harris.
So I'll start with the halachic point and you'll continue with the psychology. Clearly from a halachic point of view, you're entitled, probably obligated to tell. Problem is that you are bound by law, and if you'll tell, you may be punished for breaching confidentiality. I am now, as we talk, involved in a similar case of a from Jewish family that has this syndrome, and the father has already contracted cancer, but he didn't tell anyone that it is this type of hereditary, that his 8 or 9 children that they have may have it. And one of the daughters is now having cancer. And we asked the parents to allow to screen the rest of the family to see who is more prone to getting cancer in order to follow them more closely and prevent as much as we can. And they refuse, and the reason is shidduchim, obviously. It's not a Muslim family. I don't know if the Muslims have the same consideration, but in a frum community, there is a major, major deterrent factor that they don't want to tell, they don't want to test, because whoever will test positively is doomed. They can't find a shidduch, right? In Israel, the law is different than in New Jersey, and an ethics committee has the power to impose relating such a serious disease to a potentially affected person, even against the consent of the parents. So we called the parents and we told them, either you are telling them or we are telling them, but your children will know and we will follow them because it's a life-saving procedure. It doesn't matter what the shidduchim will be, you are going to lose children and we can't let it go. So the last thing, last week we had a meeting with this family. The mother said, give me 3 months. I have to prepare myself. I have to see how to do it and who to tell and how to test and how to do it so that neighbors won't know and all kinds of things. We gave them 3 months, and when the 3 months will be up, we will enforce it because life takes precedence over all other considerations.
Sake of time, I mean, this is in a way easy on the psychological side because even when there aren't life-threatening issues, both the research and I'm sure your experience with siblings of kids with cancer is the more they know, the better. Some of them may resist it or whatever, but invariably, every study I've ever seen shows that open disclosure is a path to more resilience. Here, you know, it's simple. You know, they need to be told, and the aftermath otherwise is I can't even imagine how devastating it would be. You know, but yes. I didn't even have to take the mic.
Too late.
I do. Toby.
Firsthand doesn't mean that I did all the testings and all the research and everything. Firsthand means that I am the treating physician and I know from the material and from my experience and from my clinical work that this is true, that this patient has epilepsy, that this patient has AIDS. I know it because the lab showed that he has HIV or that the EEG showed that there's a pattern of epilepsy, but that is regarded as firsthand. What is not regarded as firsthand, for instance, is a nurse that reads the chart, but she really didn't get involved enough in the patient. Sometimes the nurse is also a firsthand knowledge if she gets all the material and she is the supervising nurse of the patient. But a nurse that just takes care of the superficial aspects and she hears that this is what he has, that may be a second-hand knowledge. But a physician that treats the patient, a pathologist perhaps may not be necessarily a first-hand source because the pathology may show one thing and the clinical aspect is different and the consequences of the clinical process may be different than just the slide. Sometimes it's enough. I mean, if all you need to know that there's cancer, the slide shows cancer, so the pathologist is also firsthand. But the clinician certainly would be regarded firsthand.
You're to solve the Shidduch crisis in the next 3 minutes.
Got it. So it's obviously a very, very complex issue. For the most part, there is a mismatch. I do have a story, but basically the reality is that very often there are many more highly qualified women, if you just look at it from a simple standpoint, you know, women who are much more accomplished, and just a simple comparison will show you that there's a shortage of qualified men. And that's a reality. The other issue is that men have much more choice. They could go younger, and there's a tremendous glut, I hate to use that word, of women who are younger, and men are naturally drawn to younger. There's real efforts to try to change that, to try to change the attitudes of men, to try to get them to date, to go out with women either their age or only a year or two younger, because without that, the default setting is going to be that. And the other problem is the more choice you have, the less satisfied you are with what you get. And because men, who are not only less qualified in many ways, but they also have a tremendous amount of choice, they get drunk with it. It's very hard, for example, at YU Connects to get guys to show up to events or to get guys to go out with certain women who would probably be perfect for them. So we're working as hard as we can on trying to change that, but we'll need about 5 minutes, not 3 minutes.
Well, it depends how important this family history is to this particular person in a shidduch. Sometimes there is a family history of totally unrelated issues to the person. So that may be irrelevant and that there won't be an obligation to tell. It might be a good advice to do it because if there are diseases in the family, that may far-reach have an implication. But if it is a genetic disease in the family, then obviously that is part of the knowledge because even if he is healthy, if there is a genetic disease, the offspring may have this disease and the other side ought to know it. And that has to be calculated. Sometimes it's irrelevant, but if it is, it's either affecting the mutual life between the husband and wife or their offspring. Both are important to the decision whether to marry or not to marry a person.
I think people want to go home. So on behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank our speakers this morning. And once again, have a safe trip and hope to see you again, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, next year.